Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive, just off Veterans Parkway in Washington in Bloomington, serving Bloomington Normal and surrounding cities with gourmet cheeses, chocolates, olives, and foods from around the world. A grand opening taste testing day will be held Saturday, April 1st. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who was a participant, a key figure in the Black Power movement of the 1960s. She is an educator, lawyer, writer, and activist. Her name is Kathleen Cleaver, and from 1967 to 1971, she served as the communications secretary of the Black Panther Party. She was the first woman member of their central committee. She became involved in politics when she was in college. She was at Barnard, and she dropped out in 1966 to work full-time with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She married Eldridge Cleaver, another important figure in the Panthers, in 1967, shared a number of years of exile with her former husband, from whom she was later divorced. She came back to the United States in 1975. She got a history degree from Yale, then a law degree from Yale, and has gone on to have a career in academia. She has been assistant professor of law at Emory University, visiting faculty member at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law in New York City and the Graduate School of Yale College, also Sarah Lawrence College. She has written a lot on the politics of America, particularly of this period. Her writing has appeared in many places, including Ramparts, Village Voice, Boston Globe, others. She's the co-editor of a collection of essays entitled Liberation, Imagination, and the Black Panther Party. It was published in 2001. She will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. She'll be here, in fact, on Friday to give a talk. This is in the MillerCom series. Her talk, The Black Power Movement, Self-Determination, Transformation, and Sabotage. That's the title. She'll be speaking at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon in room 112 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. And, of course, anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. These programs are always open to the public and free. Questions here on this program, of course, are always open. And if people would like to call in, make a comment, ask a question, that's certainly possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana. In fact, if you're listening on the internet, you can use the toll-free line as long as you're in the United States. And that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks here where we are. But toll-free, 800-222-9455. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Ms. Cleaver, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. I think when one uses the phrase or hears the phrase black power, I'm sure that people have all kinds of associations with it.
And there is nothing we can do about it.
Well, you know, some may be negative, some may be positive, and of course people will think about the Black Panthers. I realize this is probably a big question, a very complicated question, but what does that mean to you? What does black power mean to you?
I heard Black Power in 1966, right when the March on Fear that Stokely Carmichael and Martin Luther King and Floyd McKissick and all these people were on this march going across Mississippi. It was all in the news. So when I heard it right when it happened. And what it meant to me was solidarity, a call for unity, called for black people to pull together. And it's a shortened version of a phrase that was being used in one of the SNCC projects, political power for black people. The Black Panther Party had its 10-point platform and program drawn up. It drew it up in October 1966. So that's like a few months after the call for black power went out. And their first point was, we want power to determine the destiny of our black community. I think that's the essence of it. It's a form, a way of saying, in the context of a society that was still struggling with the consequences of having had a slave-based economy, not only in the South, but all over. It's just that people seem to forget that slavery was part of all of America when it started, and they tend to concentrate on the South. But the opposite, the very opposite of enslaved people are empowered people. And since we assume most of the slaves were black, or if they weren't black, they were counted as black, then it's finally reversing that dynamic. That's what I heard. Now, I am sure, because I heard it based on my experience, my education. I came from a family of people who had been involved in the civil rights struggle before I was even born. My father was involved in challenging the all-white primary in Texas. My mother had been involved in something called the Southern Negro Youth Congress. So my environment in which I'm going to hear black power is very different from somebody who reads about it in the newspaper, and entirely different from some, let's say, white Southerner who's out there waving a flag saying, you know, go back to Africa, and other more impolite things that they said towards the demonstrators. Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly, a lot of people at the time felt threatened by the Black Panthers and by other kind of grassroots political organizations that sprang up at the time. And I think I was very struck by a comment that you made in one of the number of interviews with you that I read, where you felt that people perhaps still today misunderstand, that they have some misperceptions of what the Black Panther Party was all about, and that goes back to the kind of negative coverage it got in the press at the time. And it centers around sort of three things: the issue of use of arms or violence, the way the people within the party thought about white people, and the role of women. And I was really struck by that and really interested in that, and having you talk a little bit more about those three things.
Well, when you say people were threatened, you clearly mean white people. The people who felt protected and inspired by the Black Panthers aren't threatened. What they are threatened by is all the forms of institutionalized violence, discrimination, and hostility that they encounter when they go to work, that they encounter when they interact with the police, that they encounter when they can't get good schools or good jobs or decent health care. So you've already said that the threat, you've placed the threat of the Black Panthers on a population that wouldn't join the Black Panthers. So, you know, that's part of the whole issue of who is telling the story of who these people are. The way most people got to know about the Black Panthers was through either seeing something on television or reading something in the newspaper. Now, the bulk of what was written in the mass media, the mainstream newspapers, was written from the perspective of the white middle-class person, and it was totally unsympathetic and many times not even true. For example, a significant number of articles were written by reporters who are plugged in and work for the FBI. So they would say things that the FBI had approved, or they would just run stories that the FBI had written in order to generate the kind of hostility and fear, particularly fear, that they wanted, so that people wouldn't question the fact that the way the police and the FBI were operating was totally illegal and unconstitutional. And that's finally all came out in the Church Committee hearings in 1976. But of course, if you read this stuff in 1967 or 1968, you're not going to connect what you read then, and your emotions aren't going to change from what you read then to something that some government committee, Senate Committee for the Study of Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence. I mean, that's not going to change it. So you've already kind of poisoned the well, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, there was already, before the Black Panthers came into existence, which was in 1966, of course you have to admit, there was already a deep-seated fear of black people when they challenged any form of control. I mean, black people were fine as long as they sort of like were seen and not heard, that kind of thing. People were frightened by the demonstrations. They were frightened by the riots. If you look, go back to 1957, when the segregation of little Central High School in Little Rock was ordered, and white mobs came out to fight this handful of black students going into their school. So there was a lot of fear already about the changes in the society that were going to take place to make the society correspond to what the Constitution and the law required. They've been so out of compliance, you might say, for so long, people were accustomed to that, particularly white Southerners. The level of violence, the level of church bombings, the level of brutality, the level of arrest that people who were in the movement were subjected to, who do you think that's going to frighten? I mean, this is what's bothering me. This whole issue of fear is portrayed from the perspective of those people who are observing and not from those people who are getting their heads whipped. So then this issue of arms. Now, under the Constitution and all over the country, there's a right to bear arms. Every state and every city has some type of regulation about under what circumstances you can do this. In California, where the Black Panthers started, the organization that I was part of, because there was Black Panther parties in many other parts of the country, but the one I'm referring to is the one that was started in Oakland in 1966 in October, and it was called initially the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. In California, the possession of weapons was regulated as a fish and game measure, and it was no crime to have a weapon displayed openly unless you had live ammunition in the chamber. So, that, you know, it's just the kind of laws that allow people to carry their shotguns on the rack driving around or carry them on their person. It's an old law, and as soon as the Black Panthers legally began patrolling Oakland police and observing them as in the way that the police may use their authority to abuse black citizens, and patrolling them with weapons, the police made an effort to have the law changed. The law was changed. The patrols were ended. So it's unbalanced in the sense that the violence has been brought against black people, the riots and the uprisings that were caused because of police murders and killings of young black men that happened over and over and over again. You know, that's not condemned. What's condemned is, oh, those people are armed. The underlying, in my view, the underlying understanding is they are armed and they are angry and all the bad things that happen to them, they're going to take it out on us. I mean, I think that's the dynamic you're looking at. So that's the unadmitted dynamic. But it wasn't an illegal possession of weapons, and it was not at all an unjustified possession of weapons. When you hear or read that at that time, under the McCarran Act, I believe it was the McCarran Act, there were provisions for mass incarceration, provisions to sort of restore California's concentration camps that they had interred the Japanese during World War II, and there's statutes that could allow them to round up people and put them in those camps. And so there was a lot of concern, a lot of fear. It was an era that had seen the assassination of a president and the assassination of Martin Luther King. And so it's understandable that there was fear, but I think we have to understand where the fear is coming from and how many people were frightened. And America is a country, for better or for worse, that's kind of made its name through violent activity, not through peaceful activity. You know, they didn't, you know, have peaceful relations with the indigenous people. The slave trade was not a peaceful activity. And so the requirements, in many instances, what it seems, if you are part of that community that's been subjected to violence, that the demands for peacefulness is a demand for acquiescence. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a couple of callers I want to bring into the conversation. We're talking with Kathleen Cleaver. She is an educator, a lawyer, writer, and activist. She served as the National Communications Secretary for the Black Panther Party. And this was from 1967 until 1971. She served as the party's spokesperson and press secretary. She was the first female member of the party's decision-making body, the Central Committee, has been continued to be involved in politics since. She's a graduate of the Yale University Law School. She's been a lawyer. She's also been a teacher. She's going to be here on the campus a little bit later in the week on Friday to give a talk about the Black Power movement. And here on this program, questions are welcome, of course, as always. 333-9455 is the number to call here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have that toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some folks here who are listening, starting with Champaign and Line 1. Hello.
Yes, hi. One way in which the Black Power movement was framed back then and historically now is in terms of relationships between Jews and blacks and the effect that the Black Power movement had on relationships between blacks and Jews in the Civil Rights Movement. And one way that that has been framed, which I don't necessarily agree with, of course, is that somehow the Black Power brought an element of anti-Semitism into the Civil Rights Movement or into the black struggle. And usually the examples that are given are people like Stokely Carmichael and Amiri Baraka and so forth. And especially after the 1967 Arab-Israeli War and the increased identification of the Black Power movement or the Black Liberation movement with the Palestinian cause, that was simply increased exponentially. And I was just wondering, I know it's a big question, but I was wondering what your particular perspective is on that particular problem and how it's been framed in the discourse about race in this country.
Well, clearly,
and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, thanks for the question.
Clearly, something that's been framed by people who have a vested concern with what they call anti-Semitism. When I was in SNCC, and I joined SNCC in 1966 in New York, and worked in Atlanta, then moved on to the Black Panther Party in the Bay Area, I never, ever heard any comments or any discussion or any statements that could be in the vaguest way construed as anti-Semitic. What I would say is that there were a significant number of whites who had participated at some time, and particularly during the 1964 Mississippi Project, who came to participate in organizations and projects and activities that SNCC had started. There were members of SNCC or activists, I think we were called organizers in SNCC, who were white, and of that group, a significant number were Jewish. So what you get is at the time of the transformation by the ideas, the concepts, the notions of black power, one of which was that the organizations for the black struggle should be led by and supported by and have members that are part of the same group, essentially a form of group solidarity or closing ranks, that necessitated the removal of any whites from decision-making power, and later it requires the removal of whites entirely. Now, what happens is that if a significant percentage of those people who were asked to leave or asked to no longer be members are Jewish, then you get the framing that this is an anti-Semitic measure, when in fact it's a pro-black measure. Does that make sense?
I hope so. The caller rang off. So
okay, and then the other issue is there was a news story based on research done by a SNCC activist whose name was Jack Minnitz, and he'd done research for a long time on the issue of the development of the State of Israel, and he had written something about the ways in which the Stern Gang that Moshe Dayan had led prior to the creation of the State of Israel, the kind of techniques they used to win Israeli independence, and then how some of these techniques were essentially terrorist techniques were being continued in fighting to control the land that Palestinians had been evacuated from. And that story was published in something called the Student Voice, which was a SNCC paper. I was in SNCC at the time. I think I was in SNCC. I think I came in after it had happened. In any case, it was extraordinarily controversial. As a consequence of that story being printed in the Student Voice, the fundraising activities, which were based in New York and had many Jewish people involved in raising money for SNCC, the fundraising base collapsed. And that led ultimately to the collapse, financial collapse of the organization. And there was a belief among the Jewish people that that article was an attack on them. It was a historical article, and I don't really, I can't go into great detail about it now. This is something that happened, I believe, in early 1967. And so, but the correspondence, he brought up that with the war, I think it was a war between Egypt and Israel that, they called it the Six-Day War, and Egypt was defeated, and all the Arabs that fought in that war were defeated, and Israel expanded its boundaries. And Stokely Carmichael, who was no longer the chairman of SNCC, I think, at the time, but Stokely Carmichael very, very clearly stated that there had to be support for the Palestinians under those circumstances in which their lands were taken and they were evacuated. And so that became a tremendous issue of what I would say is there's a use of the term anti-Semitic, but the concept was a political concept against certain forms of Zionist expansion, and therefore it was sort of, from my perspective, it seemed as if the black civil rights movements didn't have the choice, from those people who are claiming this is anti-Semitic, they didn't have the choice to decide in the Six-Day War which side they would articulate support for. That's my take on it.
All right. Well, let's go on to another caller here. Coles County is the next person. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I thought I would mention something that might be of interest. I was present for the last public appearance, or at least one of the last public appearances, of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader, in 1969, only 4 days before his murder in Chicago. I was present for a speech by Fred Hampton in 1969 at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And of course, he was a very dynamic and charismatic speaker, very, very impressive. And only about, I believe, 4 days later, he was murdered, of course, in Chicago in the infamous events up there. And it was interesting. When we went in there at SIU Carbondale, went in for the speech, we were frisked a little bit. There was just a little patting down or frisking. And I remember at the time, I thought, well, maybe the Black Panthers are just a little bit paranoid, maybe a little. And I realized, of course, 4 days later that I was very wrong, that they weren't paranoid at all. And so I thought I would just mention that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you brought it up. And
Okay.
What I will comment on is I never went to Chicago while Fred was the chair there that I remember. I may have passed through the airport, but the people, everyone I have ever spoken to that had any contact, whether they were a member of the party, whether they were a neighbor, or whether they just heard him speak one time, they found him unforgettable.
Yes, yes, I agree. I agree. And in fact, that's a good way to put it. He should never be forgotten.
Well, there seems to be an effort underway now in the city of Chicago to name a small portion of a street near where he lived. I think it's Fred Hampton Way.
There's a lot of opposition to it, unfortunately.
Well, the opposition seems to be generated by the, what is it called, FOP, Fraternal Order Police?
Oh, yeah, sure.
But, you know, this is America. Let's duke it out here.
Actually, I think that he deserves something better than just a block or two of street, to tell you the truth. I think there should eventually be some kind of a statue or something.
I think so, too.
I think
that's a great idea. In fact, they should get the land and then say, now we want a statue.
Yeah, I think it should be something. I don't think a block or two of street really means anything, to be very honest. I think it ought to be something more significant and maybe even a little museum kind of thing where there's information about him and so forth.
Well, I think a statue is a good place to start because that's when people memorialized. You can't take down their statues.
Well, I thank the caller for the comment. Just a quick question. Two people should understand, or maybe they will remember, that the Black Panthers was one of the groups, and there were a number of groups who were on the left politically, the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, the anti-war movement, the socialist workers that were targeted by the government through the FBI in this program people I'm sure probably have heard of, COINTELPRO, so that there was an active effort by the government to disrupt these organizations. At the same time, I think you would have to say, if you look at the history of the Panthers, that there certainly was internal conflict that may have contributed to the party eventually declining and coming apart. I mean, if you ask this question, to what extent was the eventual decline of the Black Panthers the result of conflict among people in the leadership, and to what extent it was the result of having been directly, deliberately targeted by the government of the United States, which of those two things do you think would have been more important?
Well, you have to recognize that any organization that has a very difficult challenge in its goals and a ambitious set of changes that it wants to implement, any such organization will have internal conflict. There will always be disagreements over tactics, disagreements over strategies, and what you call little petty personality conflicts. There is no organization from the White House down to your local PTA that you don't see internal conflict. So let's just set that aside for a minute. What you see in the COINTELPRO is an intervention on the part of the government based on information that they got through tapping phones, spying on people, following people, and sending in agent provocateurs to cause internal dissension. What you see is an intervention into that existing internal conflict and the elevation of elements in that conflict to the breaking point. So it's not the presence of the conflict that is key. It's the manner in which the internal conflict was discouraged, encouraged, manipulated by outside forces. Because without the intervention of the FBI, the internal conflicts could have been resolved quite civilly. They wouldn't require, as they ended up leading to the expulsion of Central Committee members and murder of people back and forth on the different sides of this so-called split. That is not the way the conflict necessarily would have been resolved without the intervention of the government.
We are at our midpoint here. We have some other callers who will get right to. Let me introduce again our guest, Kathleen Cleaver. She is an educator, lawyer, writer, activist. She's senior lecturer in law at the Emory School of Law at Emory University. That's in Atlanta. Also senior lecturer in the Department of African and African American Studies at Yale. She was involved with the Black Panther Party from 1967 until 1971. She was the communications secretary, the national communications secretary, and also was the first woman to be a member of the party's decision-making body, the Central Committee, has continued to be involved in politics since, has written a good deal about contemporary American politics and politics of this time. She is the co-editor of a collection of essays entitled Liberation, Imagination, and the Black Panther Party, published by Routledge in 2001, and has also contributed to a lot of other magazines and newspapers. She'll be here to talk about the Black Power movement on Friday. She'll be speaking at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, room 112 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. This is an event in the MillerCom series, so anyone interested in attending should feel welcome. And here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let us go next to Champaign County for another caller, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I don't want to digress too much, but in Chicago, statues can be taken down, actually, at the history of the Haymarket Square area is that the FOP, the police and the powers that be, always kept putting up a statue of to the memory of the police at the Haymarket Square events. And it periodically got brought down. So
Very interesting. I'm fascinated by that. So thank you so much for telling me. I just think it's problematic.
Yeah.
Problematic that in the United States, in the issue of public art, if you go around and count all the statues in the United States, you'll find more statues of horses than of women.
Uh huh.
And you'll probably find way more statues of horses than of black people.
Yeah, well, I definitely think we need to commemorate Fred Hampton's memory for sure. And the argument is at least raising some consciousness. And I don't think enough people have heard about COINTELPRO and the kind of detail of what was going on. I think it was more pernicious in L.A. that the FBI would pass out pamphlets as if they came from one faction of the Panthers, you know, that were, you know, scurrilously attacking another. So they were purposely trying to instigate this internecine fighting. And that isn't the least of it. It was a great book, I think. I don't know, Agents of Repression by Ward Churchill, and he also has a companion book called Documents of COINTELPRO that, you know, chronicles this and reproduces a lot of this stuff. Maybe this is a digression, but I think I just heard recently that Kwame Ture, which was Stokely Carmichael's name after he went back to Africa, changed it to that, that he brought the image of Panther in the sense that he was working with I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, that he brought the image of a cat that was used in a rural Mississippi voter.
So let me explain.
Okay,
what he was working on was something called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization in Alabama. It was a political party based on Alabama law that allowed you to start your own party because Lowndes County had never, ever elected any black official in its history, and it's a 90% black county in the Black Belt of Alabama, a very poor county. They created, SNCC went in and created the Lowndes County Freedom Organization after the sort of lack of success at the Democratic Convention in 1964 for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to unseat the Democratic delegation. So therefore the decision was made, well, working within the Democratic Party structure is not going to yield us the kind of political impact we need, so let's start our own party. And it was called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, and it ran black candidates, and it had a logo, and the logo for the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, and I understand the Democratic Party's logo was a rooster, a white rooster with a ribbon around it. It said, "White Supremacy for the Right." That's the logo of the Democratic Party. The Lowndes County Freedom Organization logo was a panther. And the panther was a black panther, and it was a drawing that was made by a volunteer student who traced the mascot of a football team of a black college in Atlanta that was called the Panthers. And so they had these competing logos, you might say, the rooster and the panther. And one of the slogans in the election was, "The Black Panther is going to eat up the white rooster."
Yeah.
But anyway, Huey Newton saw a pamphlet in Oakland, and it was a pamphlet for the election of John Hewlett, who was running for sheriff on the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, but the press started calling that group the Black Panther Party, and so they started calling it the Black Panther Party. So it was John Hewlett's campaign pamphlet about vote for the Black Panther, pull the Black Panther lever. And at that time, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale had already come up with a 10-point platform and program for an organization they were going to start. And they had the idea of the organization. They just didn't have a name for the organization. And when he saw that pamphlet, he said, "Oh, this is the name that we can use. We'll use the Black Panther Party." But since they already had that name in Alabama, they called their organization the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense.
Well, it seems like it symbolically links, you know, this urban Oakland community to the broader civil rights struggle.
No, it's not symbolic. It's direct.
Yeah.
It's a direct implication. It's sort of like the Black Panther became the symbol of black power because Stokely Carmichael was the person who articulated it, and here's Stokely Carmichael working in Lowndes County, and they're calling it the Black Panther Party, and so the ideas are congruent. It's more than symbol is direct. In fact, I was told that Huey wrote a letter to SNCC and asked for permission to use that drawing for his organization.
I guess I meant it sort of, well, it emblematically ties them together, and it shows that the, you know, the Black Panther movement, you know, as far as being ostracized from the wider civil rights movement, was sort of organically came out of it. And this reminds me of the whole dichotomy that, though, seems to me the white analysts give of the difference between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. They were maybe strategically different, but they weren't as opposed as people make out. So,
well, let's say
they
weren't as opposed as people would like to believe.
Let's take another call. Let's go to Champaign, and this is line 3. Hello.
Hi, David. Thanks again for having such wonderful guests, and Ms. Cleaver. What I hear you saying when you answer David's questions is you keep answering with examples of what I've come to know as social engineering. And so I want to put a blunt question to you and with an explanation of why I'm asking. Is slavery over in America? In Champaign, I occasionally overhear conversations of young Black men who identify themselves as gangbangers. They're really intelligent. They're very articulate. But they voice concerns over personal safety and other life functions that you and I would think are completely normal. But they brag about time that they serve in prison, and they wear it like a badge of honor. And it got me to thinking that this social engineering that we have with lack of jobs and education, no police presence in high-crime neighborhoods, it actually forces the youth into these positions where crime and incarceration are actually scripted for them. And I'd like your comments on that.
Well, you're completely correct that crime, involvement in crime, or what you could call an underground economy, or gangs, which some people refer to as youth organizations, is a survival mechanism in an environment in which legitimate work and decent housing and education that helps them get ahead is kind of a thing of the past. But just about the issue of slavery, under the Constitution, the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution calls for the abolition of slavery and involuntary servitude, which is another term implying, usually sort of a form of peonage or indentured work that's coerced. But the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery and indentured servitude, involuntary servitude, except for those people who've been duly convicted of crimes. So when you ask, is slavery over, under the Constitution, a conviction of a crime permits slavery. So when you look at the numbers of young Blacks who have been arrested, have been convicted, have been incarcerated, particularly if you look at those who've been incarcerated in these private prisons, these prisons that are constructed by companies that are traded on the stock exchange and that engage in incarceration as a form of corporate business, and who profit from their occupancy of their prisons, and who have pushed for certain things like the three strikes you're out laws and other legal measures to enhance prison occupation, which is all very, very problematic. Investigated a lot by groups called like Critical Resistance, who refer to this process as something that a prison industrial complex. What I would like to say is that under the way the Supreme Court looks at slavery, chattel slavery, the reduction of a human being to commodity, and the treating of persons as property, if the slavery doesn't reach to that level, the Supreme Court won't see it as slavery. However, under the facts of what we call human trafficking, you're probably familiar with these people who smuggle immigrants and smuggle Asians and Latinos into the United States for a fee, and then continue to take payment from them and their families for a long period of time to cover the, you know, exorbitant rates they charge for the smuggling. We have novel forms of commodification, novel forms of slavery that's not recognized as maybe slavery in the chattel sense, but it is made illegal under anti-trafficking statutes, particularly when these forms of trafficking, human trafficking, are used for sexual exploitation. So to answer your question, there's newer versions of the complete violation of a person's human integrity by activity that should be, and in some cases is, criminalized.
I appreciate the comments of the caller, and we have several people who are holding, and we're moving into about our last 10, 12 minutes here, so I hope you'll forgive me if I'm going.
Okay, I'll try and be
shorter. Well, no,
tell them to ask simpler questions.
See, that's the problem. People like to ask questions that are good questions, but that are complicated questions. Having said that, just the comments of the caller take me back to something that you said earlier in the program about the fact that we do not often acknowledge the extent to which slavery was an important part of the establishing of this country, that there was slavery all over the United States in early America, not just in the South, and that it was a fundamental part of the economy, not just of the South, also of the North. That I think you have said that people, Americans today, don't fully appreciate or acknowledge the role that slaves played and slavery's played in establishing, getting the United States going as a country.
In fact, it was crucial. It was a crucial role. It was the fundamental economic engine.
And is there a way in which today in the United States is still marked by this?
I think there's unquestionable that the United States is still marked, particularly in what you called... Okay, if you have a society in which there's a fundamental distinction made between people who own property, and part of that property is human beings, and people who are construed as property, and those people who are construed as property are descendants of Africans or Africans and Indians or Africans and whites, the phrase in the law will be Negroes, mulattoes, Indians, people of color that these statutes apply to. So when you have a population that's so-called racially defined as a descendant of slaves and another population that's racially defined as descendants of people who own slaves, whether or not there's any presence of slavery, the institutions of culture, institutions of political and social and economic power, the cultural power, the economic power, the political power, maintains and builds upon those kind of distinctions. And the way we experience it is in what's very, very loosely referred to as racism.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. I want to get at least one other caller in the time that remains. We'll go to Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Listening with close interest. I was picked up a book called The 60s Reader, and it has a large part devoted to the Black Panther Party. And the part of it has to do with a transcript of a call-in show that Eldridge Cleaver was on in 1968 with Del Shields, something called Night Call. And somebody called in and asked if Cleaver had read The Life of Gandhi, and because this person was saying that he thought violence always begets violence. And Cleaver had a great answer. He said that Gandhi was dealing with people other than these racist Yankees that we are dealing with here. He was dealing with a minority of occupying forces, and we are dealing with a majority of very complacent people who surround us and have us dispersed throughout their population. Then he talked a little bit about some of this violence, and he said, don't come to the black community and teach to victims of this violence to be nonviolent, but teach the perpetrators of this violence to be nonviolent, and then we can talk about it.
That's a great answer. Thank you. I wasn't aware of that transcript, but thank you very much.
Yeah. well, I was going to say if you wanted to, I heard in your biography or in the list of your affiliations and accomplishments that you were related, you had something to do with nonviolence. I was just curious if you would distance yourself from that, because I tend to think
it's a good point,
true.
Because I was in a Quaker high school when I saw the demonstrations going on in Birmingham, and when I was in college when the little children, four girls were killed in the bombing. And there was a time in which I was impressed. I was, in fact, inspired by what we call passive resistance or nonviolent direct action. And one of the things that was inspiring was first that it engaged the people of my age, you know, high school kids, to go out and demonstrate and challenge segregation, which is something I was very familiar with from having lived in Alabama. So that part was inspiring. The resistance part of it was inspiring. And the other part was that the philosophy of nonviolence was a philosophy based on what they call satyagraha, speaking truth to power. So that, you know, I learned about this when I was 17 years old. We were very impressed with the power of truth and the power of the ability of your energy as a loving, truthful person to transform a violent opponent. So that was somewhat appealing. However, you get to the point when you realize you're dealing with institutionalized violence, institutionalized racism, structures that could only be analogous to a colonial form of domination. Once that understanding became clear to me, it seemed to me that the techniques have to be broader than that. Not that there's no place for negotiation, speaking truth to power, civil disobedience, boycotts. It's not that there's no place for that, but there has to be a place for a broader array of challenges to the forms of domination to which we were being subjected.
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the caller. I'd like to try and do at least one more here. Someone listening this morning in Charleston. That is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, two comments. The first is the differences in chattel slavery and wage slavery is not much distance between them, because the circumstances of the chattel slave and the wage slave, the chattel slave receives his bowl of oatmeal and a shack to live in, which the investor must maintain his life, whereas the wage slave has absolutely no recourse. Once he is not able to make wages or cannot find a job, nobody cares. And the other comment is, I were fairly young in the 60s when all these things were going on, and one of the most heartrending pictures I ever saw was the Black Panthers, I think it was in Oakland, a whole group of men stripped naked.
Oh, that's Philadelphia.
Is it Philadelphia? Okay.
Yes, that was Rizzo.
I'm sorry. I thought it was Rizzo. But in any case, they stripped these men down, and among them was a 17-year-old boy who was abashed to take off his underwear, and the police killed him.
Oh, no, you're talking about something else. That was the other killing of Bobby Hutton. There was only two people in that arrest.
Okay,
and he did take off only his shirt, and he was murdered.
Yes, yeah. Okay, well, thank you for helping me out.
I just want to tell you, there's a significant difference that you leave out in the wage slave and the chattel slave, and that difference is the vote. The wage slave, if the wage slave can vote, can form political parties, can run for office, and can enact legislation that protects the wage slave, form unions to protect the wage slave, and those are things that the chattel is unable to do. They have to completely abolish the regime of slavery to get out of it. So there is a small difference.
Just very quickly, we really don't have very much time left, but one thing I'd like to have you talk at least for a minute or two about. Beck, near the beginning of the program, was talking about how I was really struck by a quote in an interview where you talked about things that people misunderstood about the Black Panther Party, one of them being that it was the image that one got of the party in the media was that it was basically all male.
Well, yes, because all males ran the newspapers and sent out the photographers, and they took pictures of men. I mean, there was plenty of women in the party. When it started, there was a smaller number, but as it grew, it got larger. And by 1969, there was 2/3 of the members of the Black Panther Party were women. And so the image is based on the media and not on engagement with the party. Hmm. And in 1970, Huey Newton promulgated a declaration for the party that called for support for women's liberation and gay liberation. In 1970, and that's like not part of the image at all. I mean, not too many organizations, including the United States Congress, seem to have managed that one yet.
Well, we're at the point here where we're going to have to finish. I want to again tell people who are listening here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, that our guest, Kathleen Cleaver, will be speaking on the Black Power Movement, Self-Determination, Transformation, and Sabotage. That's the title of the talk. This is Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock, room 112 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. This is an event in the MillerCom series. It is free and open to the public, and certainly anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. This week, here on the campus of the university, there's a major conference going on looking at the legacies of Black Power. A lot of people have come here to take part, and again, tomorrow morning on the show, we will talk with a couple of guests who are here to take part, including Ron Mincy, who is a professor of social policy at Columbia, who has done a lot of writing about Black men in America today. And then also we'll talk with V.P. Franklin. He's an historian at Dillard University, and talk some more about the legacies of Black Power. So that's tomorrow morning, both of the hours of the program. And we want to say, Ms. Cleaver, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to be able to talk to people. And I will say, you have a highly intelligent group of callers.
Well, you're not the first guest to say so. We believe that that is indeed the case. Thank you.
Thank
you. The broadcast today here on Focus 580 made possible with support from the Orpheum Children's Science Museum. It's a hands-on children's science center. It's located at 346 North Neal Street in downtown Champaign, where science meets center stage, on the web at orpheum.science.museum. Focus 580, this program also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. One word about something going on a little bit later today here as part of our schedule. With the election of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger as Pope, it appears that the Roman Catholic Church will continue on the path of Ratzinger's predecessor, John Paul II. On the afternoon magazine Today, a look at the Church today and its head, Pope Benedict XVI. The guest will be a former Jesuit-turned-journalist, Robert Blair Kaiser. He's a contributor in Rome for Newsweek. He's the author of a recently published book, A Church in Search of Itself. And he'll be talking with Celeste Quinn on the afternoon magazine today in the 1 o'clock hour. We are going to take a break, as we usually do. Then we'll have more Focus 580. But first, news from NPR and an update on the markets.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-